So I thought I would just continue from where Samnera Suhajo got to yesterday. So this is the second half of Toilets on the Path, Ajahn Chah. And I think I'm going to overlap just a bit, so the first part may sound familiar. You don't have to do anything original, just do the traditional things. Revive the old practices that have declined. If you allow the degeneration to continue like this, then everything will fall apart, and you will be unable to restore the old standards. So make a firm determination with your practice, both the external and internal. Don't be deceitful. Monks and novices should be harmonious and do everything in unity. Go over to that kuti and see what I've been doing. I've been working on it for many weeks now. There's a monk, a novice, and a layman helping me. Go and see. Is it done properly? Does it look nice? That's the traditional way of looking after the lodgings. After using the toilet, you scrub the floor down. In the old days, there was no water toilet. The toilets we had then weren't as good as the ones we use today. But the monks and novices were good, and there were only a few of us. Now the toilets are good, but the people that use them are not. We never seem to get the two right at the same time. Really think about this. The only problem is that lack of diligence in the practice leads to a complete disaster. No matter how good and noble a task is, it can't be accomplished if there's no grasp of the right method. It becomes a complete debacle. Recollect the Buddha and incline your mind to his Dhamma. In it you will see the Buddha himself. Where else could he be? Just look at his Dhamma. Read the teachings. Can you find anything faulty? Focus your attention on the Buddha's teaching and you will see him. Do you think that you can do what you like because the Buddha can't see you? How foolish. You're not examining yourself. If you're lazy all the time, how are you going to practice? There's nothing to compare with the slyness of defilement. It's not easy to see. Wherever insight arises, the defilements of insight follow. Don't think that if nobody objects, you can just hang out eating and sleeping. How could the Dhamma elude you if you really devoted yourselves to practice? You're not deaf and dumb or mentally retarded. You've got all of your faculties. And what can you expect if you're lazy and heedless? If you were still the same as when you arrived, it wouldn't be so bad. I'm just afraid you're making yourself worse. Reflect on this deeply. Ask yourself the question, what have I come here for? What am I doing here? You've shaved off your hair, put on the brown robe. What for? Go ahead, ask yourself. Do you think it's just to eat and sleep and be heedless? If that's what you want, you can do that in the world. Take out the oxen and buffalo, come back home, eat and sleep. Anyone can do that. If you come and act in that heedless, indulgent way in the monastery, then you're not worthy of the name of monks and novices. Raise up your spirits. Don't be sleepy or slothful or miserable. Get back into the practice without delay. Do you know when death will come? Little novices can die as well, you know. It's not just Long Pa that's going to die, but cows as well. Everyone is going to die. What will be left when death comes? Do you want to find out? You may have what you're going to do tomorrow all worked out, but what if you were to die tonight? You don't know your own limitations. The chores are for putting forth effort. Don't neglect the duties of the Sangha. Don't miss the daily meetings. Keep up both your own practice and your duties towards the community. You can practice whether you're working, writing, watering the trees, or whatever, because practice is what you're doing. Don't believe your defilements and cravings. They've led many people to ruin. If you believe defilements, you cut yourself off from goodness. Think about it. In the world, people who let themselves go can even end up addicted to drugs like heroin. It gets as bad as that, but people don't see the danger. If you practice sincerely, then Nibbana is waiting for you. Don't just sit there waiting for it to come to you. Have you ever seen anyone successful in that way? Wherever you see you're in the wrong, quickly remedy it. If you've done something incorrectly, do it again properly. Investigate. You have to listen if you want to find the good. If you nod off while you're listening to the Dhamma, the infernal guardians will grab you by the arms and pitch you into hell. Right at the beginning of a talk, during the Pali invocation, some of you are already starting to slump. Don't you feel any sense of shame? Don't you feel embarrassed to sit there like that in front of the lay people? And where did you get these appetites from? Are you hungry, ghosts, or what? At least after they've eaten, dogs can still bark. All you can do is sit there in a stupor. Put some effort into it. You aren't conscripts in the army. As soon as the chaplain starts to instruct them, the soldiers' heads start slumping down onto their chests. When will he ever stop? How do you think you will ever realize the Dhamma if you think like a conscript? Folk singers can't sing properly without a reed pipe accompaniment. The same applies to a teacher. If his disciples put their hearts into following his teachings and instructions, he feels energized. But when he puts down all kinds of fertilizer and the soil remains dry and lifeless, it's awful. He feels no joy. He loses his inspiration. He wonders why he should bother. Be very circumspect before you eat. On one prow or on any day when you tend to get very sleepy, don't let your body have any food. Let someone else have it. You have to retaliate. Don't eat at all. Quote, if you're going to be so evil, then today you don't have to eat. End quote. Tell it that. If you leave your stomach empty, then the mind can be really peaceful. It's the path of practice. Sitting there as dull as a moron, not knowing south from north, you can be here until the day you die and not get anything from it. You can still be as ignorant as you are now. Consider this matter closely. What do you have to do to make your practice, quote, good practice? Look, people come from other places, other countries, to see our way of practice here. They come to listen to Dhamma and to train themselves. Their practice is of benefit to them. Your own benefit and the benefit of others are interdependent. It's not just a matter of doing things in order to show off to others, but for your own benefit as well. When lay people see the Sangha practicing well, they feel inspired. What would they think if they came and saw monks and novices like monkeys? In the future, who could the lay people place their hopes on? As for proclaiming the Dhamma, you don't have to do very much. Some of the Buddha's disciples, like Venerable Asaji, hardly spoke. They went on alms round in a calm and peaceful manner, walking neither quickly nor slowly, dressed in sober colored robes. Whether walking, moving, going forwards or back, they were measured and composed. One morning, while Venerable Sariputta was still the disciple of a Brahmin teacher called Sanjaya, he caught sight of Venerable Asaji and he was inspired by his demeanor. He approached him and requested some teaching. He asked who Venerable Asaji's teacher was and received the answer, quote, the Reverend Gotama. Well, what does he teach that enables you to practice like this? He doesn't teach so much. He simply says that all dhammas arise from causes. If they are to cease, their causes must cease first. Just that much, that was enough, he understood. That was all it took for Venerable Sariputta to realize the Dhamma. Whereas many of you go on alms round as if you are a bunch of boisterous fishermen going out to catch fish, the sounds of your laughing and joking can be heard from far away. Most of you just don't know what's what. You waste your time thinking of irrelevant and trivial things. Every time you go on alms round, you can bring back a lot of Dhamma with you. Sitting here eating the meal, too. Many kinds of feelings arise. If you are composed and restrained, you'll be aware of them. You don't have to sit cross-legged in meditation for these things to occur. You can realize enlightenment in ordinary, everyday life. Or do you want to argue the point? Once you've removed a piece of burning charcoal from the fire, it doesn't cool straight away. Whenever you pick it up, it's hot. Mindfulness retains its wakefulness in the same way as charcoal does its heat. Self-awareness is still present. That being so, how could the mind become deluded? Maintain a concerted gaze on your mind. That doesn't mean staring at it unblinkingly like a madman. It means constantly tracking your feelings. Do it a lot. Concentrate a lot. Develop it a lot. This is called progress. You don't know what I mean by this gazing at the mind. This kind of effort and development. I'm talking about knowing the present state of your mind. If lust or ill will or whatever arise in your mind, then you have to know all about it. In practice, the mind is like a child crawling about, and the sense of knowing is like the parent. The child crawls around in the way that children do, and the parent lets it wander, but all the same, he keeps a constant eye on it. If the child looks like it's going to fall in a pit, down a well, or wander into danger in the jungle, the parent knows. This type of awareness is called the one who knows, the one who is clearly aware, the radiant one. The untrained mind doesn't understand what's going on. Its awareness is like that of a child, knowing there's craving in the mind and not doing anything about it. Knowing that you're taking advantage of someone else, eating more than your share, knowing how to lift the light weight and let someone else take the heavy one, knowing that you've got more than the other person, that's an insane kind of knowing. Selfish people have that kind of knowing. It turns the clarity of awareness into darkness. A lot of you tend to have that kind of knowing. Whatever feels heavy, you push it away and go off looking for something light instead. That kind of knowing. We train our minds as parents look after their children. You let the children go their way, but if they're about to put a hand in the fire, fall down the well, or get into danger, you're ready. Who could love a child like its parents? Because parents love their children, they watch over them continually. They have a constant awareness in their minds, which they continually develop. The parent doesn't neglect the children, but neither do they keep right on top of them all the time. Because children lack knowledge of the way things are, the parent has to watch over them, keep track of their movements. When it looks like they are going to fall down the well, their mother picks them up and carries them somewhere far from danger. Then the parent goes back to work but continues to keep an eye on the children and keeps consciously training this knowledge and awareness of their movements. When they run towards the well again, their mother picks them up and returns them to a safe place. Raising up the mind is the same. If that wasn't the case, then how could the Buddha look after you? Buddho means the one who knows, who is awakened and radiant. If your awareness is that of a small child, how could you be awake and radiant? You'll just keep putting your hand in the fire. If you know your mind but you don't train it, how could that be intelligence? Worldly knowledge means cunning, knowing how to hide your mistakes, how to get away with things. That's what the world says is good. The Buddha disagreed. What's the point of looking outside yourself? Look really close, right here. Look at your mind. This feeling arises and it's unwholesome. This thought arises and it's wholesome. You have to know when the mind is unwholesome and when it's not. Abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. That's how it has to be if you want to know. It happens through looking after the practice, including the observances regarding the dwelling place. First thing in the morning, as soon as you hear the sound of the bell, get up quickly. Once you've closed the doors and windows of the kuti, go to morning chanting. Do the group duties. And these days, as soon as you get up, you rush off, door and windows left open, pieces of cloth left on the line outside. You're completely unprepared for the rain. As soon as it starts or you hear a peal of thunder, you have to run all the way back. Whenever you leave your kuti, close the door and windows. If your robe is out on the line, bring it in and put it away neatly. I don't see many people doing this. Take your bathing cloth over to your kuti to dry. During the rainy season, put it out underneath the kuti. Don't have a lot of cloth. I've seen bhikkhus go to wash robes half buried in cloth. Either that or they're off to make a bonfire of some sort. If you've got a lot, it's a hassle. All you need is one jiwan, one sanghati, a sabong or two. I don't know what this big jumbled pile you're carrying around is. On robe washing day, some of you come along after everyone else when the water's all boiled and just go straight ahead and wash your robes obliviously. When you've finished, you rush off and don't help to clean up. The others are about to murder you. Do you realize that? When everybody is helping cutting chips and boiling the water, if there's someone who is nowhere to be seen, that's really ugly. Washing one or two pieces of cloth each shouldn't be such a big deal, but from the ding-ding sound of cutting jackfruit wood chips, it sounds like you're cutting down a huge tree to make a house post. Be frugal. If you only use the wood chips once or twice and throw them away, where do you think we're going to keep getting the wood from? Then there's firing bowls. You just keep banking up the fire more and more, and then when the bowl cracks, you throw it away. Now there's a whole pile of discarded bowls piled up at the foot of the mango tree. Why do you do that? If you don't know how to fire a bowl, then ask. Ask a senior monk. Confer with him. There have been bhikkhus who have just gone ahead and fired their bowls anyway, even though they didn't know the right method. Then when the bowl cracked, they would come and ask for a new one. How can you have the gall? This is all wrong action and bad karma. Look after the trees in the monastery to the best of your ability. Don't, under any circumstances, build fires near them so that their branches and leaves are singed. Care for the trees. I don't even allow the lay people to build fires for warming themselves on winter mornings. There was one time when some of them went ahead and did it anyway. They ended up with a head full of fleas. Worse still, ashes blew all over the place and made everywhere filthy. Only people on fishing trips do things like that. When I went to have a look around the monastery, I saw tin cans, packets of detergent, and soap wrappers strewn around the forest floor. It looks more like the backyard of a slaughterhouse than a monastery where people come to pay homage. It's not auspicious. If you're going to throw anything away, then do it in the proper place, and then all the rubbish can be taken away and be incinerated. But what's going on now? As soon as you're out of the immediate area of your kuti, you just sling your rubbish out into the forest. We're monks, practitioners of the Dhamma. Do things beautifully. Beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. Beautiful in the way that the Buddha taught us. This practice is all about abandoning defilements. So if you're accumulating them, you're going on a different path to the Buddha. He removes defilements and you're taking them on. It's sheer madness. The reason is not hard to find. It's simply that you don't reflect consistently enough to make things clear. For the reflection on birth, old age, sickness, and death to have any real effect, it has to be taken to the extent that, on waking up in the morning, you shudder. Acknowledge the fact that death could occur at any time. You could die tomorrow. You could die today. And if that's the case, then you can't just carry on blithely. You've got to get up. Practice walking meditation. If you're afraid of death, then you must try to realize the Dhamma in this time you have. But if you don't meditate on death, you won't think like this. If the bell wasn't rung so vigorously and for so long, I don't know if there'd be a single person at the morning meeting, or when you'd ever do any chanting. Some of you wake up at dawn, grab your bowl, and then rush straight off on one of the short alms rounds. Everyone just leaves the monastery when they feel like it. Talk over the question of who goes on what alms round. What time those on the Ban Gleng route should leave? What time those on the Ban Gor route should leave? What time those on the Ban Bok route should leave? Take this clock as your standard. When the bell goes, set off straight away. These days, those who leave first stand waiting at the edge of the village. The ones that leave later run to catch up. Sometimes one group has been right through the village and are already on their way out when a second group arrives. The villagers don't know what to put in the bowls of the second group. That's a dreadful way to carry on. Discuss it amongst yourselves once more. Decide who is going on which route. If anyone is unwell or has some problem and wants to change the route, then say so. There's an agreed way of doing things. What do you think you're doing, just following your desires like that? It's an utter disgrace. It would serve you right if all you got on alms round was a chisel. And there's a note, a chisel is commonly used as a weapon. A chisel put into a bhikkhu's alms bowl would be interpreted as a threat of violence. So if you need more sleep, don't stay up so late. What's all this great activity you're involved in that makes you need so much sleep? Just putting forth effort, practicing sitting and walking meditation, doesn't cause you to miss that much sleep. Spending your time indulging in socializing does, though. When you've done a sufficient amount of walking meditation and you're feeling tired, then go to bed. Divide your time correctly between Sangha activities and your own private activities so that you get enough rest. On some days in the hot season, for instance, when it's very humid, we may take a break from evening chanting. After water hauling, you can take your bath and then practice as you wish. If you want to do walking meditation, then get right down to it. You can walk for as long as you like. Try it out. Even if you walk until 7 o'clock, you've still got the whole night ahead of you. You could walk until 8 o'clock and go to sleep then if you really wanted to. There is no reason to miss out on sleep. The problem is that you don't know how to manage your time. It's up to you. Whether you get up late or early is up to you. How can you ever achieve anything without training and straightening yourself out? The training is indispensable. If you do it, this small thing will offer no difficulties. You can't just play at it. Make your practice of benefit to yourself and others. Train yourselves well in the practice. If you develop your mind, wisdom is bound to arise. If you put your heart into walking Jhangram, then after three links of the path, the Dhamma will be flowing strongly. But instead of that, you drag yourself up and down in a drowsy state with your head hung down. Those of you with broken necks, if you go in a forest or to a mountain, they say the spirits will get to you, you know. If you're sleepy while you're sitting, get up. Do some walking meditation. Don't keep sitting there. Standing, walking, or sitting, you have to rid yourself of sleepiness. If something arises and you don't do anything to solve the problem or to improve yourself, then how will it ever get better? Memorize the Padimokkha while you're walking Jhangram. It's really enjoyable and peaceful, too. Train yourself. Go on the alms round to Bangor. Keep yourself to yourself, away from the ones that like to chat. Let them go ahead. They walk fast. Don't talk with the garrulous ones. Talk with your own heart a lot. Meditate a lot. The kind of people who enjoy talking all day are like chattering birds. Don't stand any nonsense from them. Put your robes on neatly and then set off on alms round. As soon as you get into your stride, you can start memorizing the Padimokkha. It makes your mind orderly and radiant. It's a sort of handbook. The idea is not that you should get obsessed with it, simply that once you've memorized it, the Padimokkha will illuminate your mind. As you walk, you focus on it. Before long, you've got it and it arises automatically. Train yourself like that. Train yourself. You have to train. Don't just hang around. The moment that you do that, you're like a dog. In fact, a real dog is better. It barks when you walk past it late at night. You don't even do that. Why are you only interested in sleeping? Why won't you get up? You have to teach yourself by asking these questions. In the cold season, some of you wrap yourself up in your robes in the middle of the day and go to sleep. It won't do. When you go out to the toilet, bow first. Bow in the morning when the bell goes before leaving. After the meal, once you've washed your bowl and gathered your things, then bow first before going back to your kuti. Don't let those occasions pass. The bell goes for water hauling. Bow first before leaving your kuti. If you forget and you've walked as far as the central area of the monastery before you realize, then go back again and bow. You have to take the training to that level. Train your heart and mind. Don't just let it go. Whenever you forget and don't bow, then go back and bow. How will you forget if you're that diligent, when you have to keep walking back and forth? What's the attitude now? Quote, I forgot, it doesn't matter, never mind, end quote. That's why the monastery is in the state it is. I'm referring here to the old traditional methods. Now it looks as if they've disappeared. I don't know what you'd call how you do things these days. Go back to the old ways, the ascetic practices. When you sit down at the foot of a tree, then bow. Even if there's no Buddha image, bow. Your mindfulness is there if you do that. When you're sitting, maintain an appropriate posture. Don't sit there grasping your knees like a fool. Sitting like that is the beginning of the end. Training yourself won't kill you. It's just laziness that is the problem. Don't let it into your head. If you're really drowsy, then lie down, but do it mindfully, reminding yourself to get up the moment you wake and be stern with yourself. Quote, if I don't, may I fall into hell. A full stomach makes you feel weary, and weariness makes lying down seem a wonderful thing. Then if you're lying there comfortable and easy, when you hear the sound of the bell, you get very angry at having to get up. Maybe even feel like killing the bell ringer. Count. Tell your mind, if I get as far as three and I don't get up, may I fall into hell. You have to really mean it. You have to get a hold of the defilement and kill it. Don't just tease with your mind. Read the biographies of the great teachers. They're singular people, aren't they? They're different. Think carefully about that difference. Train your mind in the correct way. You don't have to depend on anyone else. Discover your own skillful means to train your mind. If it starts thinking of worldly things, quickly subdue it. Stop it. Get up. Change your posture. Tell yourself not to think about such things. There are better things to think about. It's essential that you don't just mildly yield to those thoughts. Once they've gone from your mind, you'll feel better. Don't imagine that you can take it easy and your practice will take care of itself. Everything depends on training. Some animals are able to find the food they need and keep themselves alive because they're so quick and dexterous. But then look at monitor lizards or tortoises. Tortoises are so slow that you may wonder how they can survive. Don't be fooled. Creatures have will. They have their methods. It's the same with sitting and walking meditation. The great teachers have their methods, but they're difficult to communicate. It's like that old fellow who used to live in Paibun. Whenever someone drowned, he was the one who would dive down looking for the corpse. He could keep diving for a long time until the leaves of a broken branch were all withered by the sun, and he'd find the bodies every time. If there was a drowning, he was the man to see. When I asked him how he did it, he said he knew all right, but he couldn't put it into words. That's how it is, an individual matter. It's difficult to communicate. You have to learn to do it yourself. And it's the same with the training of the mind. Hurry on with this training. I say this to you, but I'm not telling you that the Dhamma is something that you can run after, or that you can realize it through physical effort alone, by going without sleep or by fasting. It's not about exhausting yourself. It's about making your mind just right for the Dhamma.
You were living with Rinpoche. Was it the case that, maybe not as fierce as this, but the majority of the teachings or many of the teachings were more Korwat or practical matters as opposed to the high Dhamma?
I never really thought of it like that. It was all, didn't really differentiate. Because it's all aspects of training. So he would be covering, just like that, the aspects of communal harmony, standards of practice. But it's also interspersed with perspectives on how to reflect and investigate. Similar, he'll pick up perspectives for reflecting on the five khandhas or dependent origination, but he'll pull it back to ordinary things as well, because there's not really a separation. Because it isn't as if it's a beginner's dhamma, and then there's a high dhamma. So they're intertwined, interlinked. So that he'd pick up different themes, and he'd develop themes of meditation, but it'd never be that far away from how to conduct oneself skillfully in the monastery as well.
We had a question earlier. Did Rinpo Cha ever encourage people to study Dhamma? And right there, he caught it. He was saying, yeah, study the texts, pay attention to them. And it's interesting. Yeah, the context is if he was aiming to talk more at the younger ones, who probably had less, who may not have done so much study. Mm-hmm. And then that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
What
he taught wasn't sort of an absolute teaching that you apply across the board. It was whatever he taught had a specific purpose, and that was the end of suffering, how to cultivate the skills of being a practitioner.
I'm curious about the issue of discussing amongst themselves, amongst the distribution of the alms rounds. Mm-hmm. Do they have like a regular 50-month meeting to draw out straws or something? And how do they figure that out today?
I don't know how it ever got decided.
It seems like it's kind of like really open to abuse if people can sort of just take their ball and go off and
I can't remember how it And I really can't remember how it got decided.
Yeah, but in a nutshell, now it was all written down on a whiteboard, so somebody decided it. And
yeah, there's the difference of temperament.
Yeah.
Generally, it would be probably like at Patimokkha or something. Or if you are assigned to a particular, or you ask the senior monk, because usually the senior monks would all take a different alms route. And then there would be a group of monks and you would actually sort of commit to going to, because there was like, there's like at least 7 different alms routes around Wakapo, and 8 actually. So that there'd be, they'd have to keep an eye on them, but there would be generally be different monks. Ajahn Leo would always be Bhargav for years and years. He would always be the Bhargav monk. It was the furthest, mostly, pretty much the furthest. So you have to have a sense of making sure that everybody's there before you go into the village, because there would be some kind of and you would all cluster together in the front of the hall, and you would all process out together. You gather at the entrance to the village, but you had to be there, pretty much around the same time.
They bring the food back to the monastery and put it in the communal pile like they do at Upananta?
Yeah. That's a standard Wakapo practice. It was another way that practice. Another example from Ajahn Chah. I'm not sure what do we do at Bantad, or like the forest monasteries in the Dhamma tradition.
But Bantad, since there's so many people.
That's true too, yeah.
Each monk, down like Monks Jr., has a layman following him, not in the village, once they get back to Bantad. It's like a big tub.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have on special days, and they dump it in. And in the village itself, every so often there's like a station where you dump,
mm-hmm.
and then all that stuff gets driven back,
mm-hmm.
and then once you're there, you go to like your mat that you set up with your stuff there, just take a couple things, put it in your bowl, and then the rest of it, I think, just goes back to the village.
That's right. Bhagdad is they don't have a kitchen. That's right. Yeah, they don't have a kitchen. Everything is, it's a Pindabhat practice. It's sort of the Pindabhata Bhakta for Pindabhata Tudo, Dutanga practice of just eating the Pindabhat. Which there's a lot of choice. But that's how but yeah, certainly Wakapo, that's a standard practice where everybody take it back, and then it goes over the kitchen, all the Pindabhat roots, and it was all sorted out. And for many, many years it was several of the senior monks would, or senior mid, dependents, have volunteers who would pass the food out. So you were tasked with, you had to pay attention to how many people were there, and then you also have to figure that there's also the whole Meiji section needs to, so always have to make sure that there's enough food, and then, there'd be late people after that. So it's a, you had to be quite careful when you pass out the food, and you put it into the bowls, and you just eat the bowl. So that everything was shared. and that I used to that would be a part of my practice, was helping pass food over, because I hate having my food mixed in ways that I don't want. I don't like having certain standards that were kind of a challenge every single day. I remember that, because there's this great story of Ajahn Kamla. One of the monks came back from, because you make up your bowl of sticky rices, and you make from your bowl, everything else goes to the kitchen. And then monks were sitting waiting for the food to come, and Ajahn Kamla gets up and walks over to one of the monks' bowls, lifts up the lid, picks up the bowl of sticky rice, opens it up, and there's a plateau in there, which is really, you don't really see that out in the countryside that often.
He says, "Oh, look at this! I wonder how that got there."
So that's one embarrassed monk.
What is that?
That's a kind of fish.
Tuna fish.
But yeah, it's like a tuna fish. Yeah, it's nice, but it, yeah. I mean, it's a big deal when you've got a platoon. the general, I mean, it actually had some meat on it. And there's oftentimes got these. There was a sea fish.
When my father come home from Thailand, we have to fry those fish like 20 of them.
Yeah.
I remember it's where I think a bunch of them did have kitchen.
Yeah.
On the women's side. I don't think there were refrigerators, I think. Because I remember people bringing food over and hearing about Ajahn Mahabhu going over there to teach how people were cooking. I was never over there.
I think certainly for the monks, and that was what you ate, was what you got in the kindabat.
I think if people had a special, if they're doing a special practice, maybe, but in addition to all that, there was also the food that people brought. And offered in the sala. The stuff that was prepared in the kitchens. So when you brought your bowl in the hall, you could put like your towel over it so no one would put stuff in it, but that wasn't always honored. So sometimes people would put stuff in anyway, either misunderstanding or as a teacher. So we can learn a lot.
Find out, I think, incredibly well supported.
I asked Tonkosko when he was at Wat Papong about how the entrants got decided, and I was surprised, I mean, at least what I understood from him, that you kind of just showed up and there were groups of monks, and it was very organic, and then you just asked about the seniority, and is that right?
I just stayed for a few weeks.
Well, when he was there, and then you figured out your seniority, and then off the group went.
Yeah.
And it was amazing how organic. I was like, wow, so, what keeps people showing up? Can't somebody just not show up for Andra?
It's incredible, incredibly tiresome how organized we have to be. The kind of organic spontaneity is that's how things work. It works.
One aspect of, I guess, sort of core walk for lay people training, I remember just seeing at Wat Papong, you probably seem to say, there was a large mural in the kitchen, or in the area where you pick up your food, which has lots of lay people eating in very bad ways. with your mind itself. And I'm curious if you just, I mean, did you know, do you know where that came from or how long that's been there?
Yeah, a long time. It's probably been redone over the years. Yeah, show and tell of how not to do things.
Yeah, I could never read the signs in time.
But you could figure pretty it much out. Tell, yeah, you pretty much pick up what it was about.
I heard stories about Ajahn Chah sometimes directing and all the food go in a big pot and it mixed up. Did that ever happen, or?
Yeah.
And how often did that happen?
Well, certainly on the one prime, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but also, because there'd be a whole lot of little things, and you've got a big group of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes there'd be a pot that's made, you know, it's like a pot of a particular kind of curry. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you just have all these little things, so that you just put it all into one pot, and it's just easier to pass out.
The late person here tried to do that once, and it happened once.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, I think it took to take that for a short period of time. You know, that's long enough.
Yeah, it's quite organic. It's lovely how it's done. Wapapong, the alms route.
Yeah.
During Pansa, it's actually written down because the community doesn't change. But mm-hmm. Pansa, the community is changing so much that it's not written down. But but usually, like, you'll have, you know, a friend monk or a big brother monk be like, "Hey, you're going on that one today," or he'll. Usually, somebody will come up to you and tell you or grab you. You're going with me today. Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to, generally, especially when you're more junior, and especially as a Farang, you just have to be go with the flow, really. And you're never quite sure what's going to happen.
So did the ones on Charm change pretty much daily? Or
hmm?
Did one go on a different on-charm?
No. It would tend to be fairly, you do one for a while. Will change for some reason or other, and you go into that one for a while.
Yeah, it'd be like, you know, your friend grabs you, "Hey, you're going with me," and then you just keep going on that one until somebody else grabs you, maybe like a week later or something.
Do the alms roots stay the same over the years?
Alms roots stay pretty much the same. You're going to the villages that are surrounding, that are within walking distance. I think they changed the Bangor route some years ago because the road, there's a highway that goes right through the middle of Ajahn Chah's home village, and it was just getting logistically difficult for a vehicle to keep close and kept up for picking up that extra food. Just because it's turned into a four-lane highway going through the middle of the village. So it's really kind of bifurcated. So they rather going around this way, then they can sort of change around this way. So you can put you on the other side of the road.
Are most of the houses, do they try to get to most of the house, past most of the houses in each village?
Not really. It depends. Because, I mean, over time, then people are going to, and, you know, the families don't change that much. The village will grow, and others from that family will sort of move up to the edge, so then you would be following a particular route, and then, you know, they might ask you to go another way or to swing past because they're, but you know, there doesn't, the families, it's not like here where you know, average in America, I mean the average in America is 5 years that somebody is in a house. So that, I mean, there's generations. So it's there. Even if the house falls down and you build it up again, it's the same family.
Lumpur, you also have like a village would also be supporting more than just one monastery, right? You
know, oh, yes. So yeah, because there tend to be village monasteries. Most of the villages will have their own monasteries. You'll have, yeah, how many monasteries go into Tungnamulang?
Tungnamulang is, there was a lot. There was like three, but then there was four for a while.
Yeah, there's four different monasteries, like village monasteries and three little forest monasteries.
Yeah, that was actually kind of unusual in that particular village. And so you'd have like three different groups crossing each other.
Yeah. A lot of it is just the, say like Bumwai, then you've got Bumwai route, you've got the Nondang route, you've got the station route, and then they all converge on the Bumwai, of course, goes through Bumwai, but then the station route comes out of the station, it comes in the back, it goes around the back of a back part of Bumwai, and then another. There's another village over here, so it comes out and comes on this other side of Bumwai. So then, you know, there's a fair a portion of the village that is covered by Pindapa roots.
So how many villages around the Pujab come?
Oh, it's just the one.
Just one, right?
Just the one, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well
there's, if you're eating
if you count
Kantakuyan.
Yeah, if you count Kantakuyan, which is sort of, if there's a monk staying up in the cave on retreat, then you can go Pindavat to Kantakuyan, which is, you go down the cliffs,
yeah.
And then it's a little village up by the Mekong. But generally, the monks would go to the and it's a larger village.
Because I remember it was so beautiful walking down, seeing the village. And
yes.
I was there when Lumpur was there, and the villagers said, "You just missed Lumpur Sandal and Janamo 2 days ago."
Oh, really?
Yes. So beautiful, village.
No, it's a lovely spot.
I think Lumpur and Janamo came down to Binba.
Yeah, it's one of the prettiest spots in Thai monasteries in Thailand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really lovely. So get up and overlooking the Mekong River, wandering along miles and miles.
This conversation kind of reminds me of Patimokkha. I mentioned it very quickly, I don't know if anybody heard, but the cold season's over, so we've lost our Katina privileges.
Oh, right. I meant to mention that. I forgot.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too, but I thought, I didn't know how many people were keeping them.
Mm-hmm. I have to make sure people have remembered that the Katina privileges are no longer existing now. Since the Pratimokkha day. Okay.